Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold and their newest AgriGold Giant 107-day A6408, available for 2014 in Roundup Ready and also VT Triple Pro Rib. More information on A6408, including yield and drydown data, is at AgriGold.com.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for January 14, 2014. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. Also this half hour, Todd Gleason joins us from the Road of the Corn and Soybean Classic. He'll talk with University of Illinois entomologist Mike Gray. And Don Day will have agricultural weather. It's all on the Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit of Illinois, offering financial products and services specifically for the agriculture industry, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing, as well as farm cash management solutions.
Let's see how futures settled on this Tuesday afternoon. May hard red winter wheat settled at 628 and three quarters, up 10. July, 627 and a quarter, it was up 9. Soft May wheat, 586 and a quarter, up 5 and three quarters. July, 593 and a quarter, up 6. March corn, 432 and a half, down 2. July, 446 and a quarter, down 3. January soybeans went off the board at noon. The settlement there, 1339, up 12 and a quarter. March, 1307, up 12 and three quarters. And July soybeans at 1272 and three quarters, up 12. January soybean meal, 452.50, up $5.60. That off the board as well, as did the January soybean oil. It went off at 37.40, down 17 cents. February live cattle finishing the day. Well, these are last trades at the moment. 137.65, up $1.05. January feeder cattle, 168.55, up 72.5. And February lean hogs finishing at 85.90, up 52.5. And those are Tuesday's settlements and last trades from Chicago.
Support comes from Country Financial. Country Financial is hosting farm information sessions throughout Illinois from December to March. Topics include updates to the federal crop insurance program, the farm bill, and how to use grain marketing and crop insurance together to manage risk. Registration information is on their crop update website at countrycrop.com/update.
Looking at meteorologist Drew Leonard's weather highlights, he says that Argentina temperatures were seasonably warm Monday, with highs in the upper 80s and lower 90s in most of the nation. Some upper 70s and lower 80s continued in the far southeast. Argentina will be mostly dry through Friday of this week, and temperatures will turn hot once again. Extreme highs will be well into the 90s and over 100 degrees and are expected during the middle to latter part of the week. Weather systems moving across Argentina late this week into the weekend and through early parts of next week should bring some relief to Argentina's driest areas. Three waves of cold will move through the eastern U.S. during the coming week. Temperatures in the Midwest and eastern states will not be as cold as those last week, however. Dry weather will continue in the western half of the U.S. through this coming week, with temperatures notably warm.
Support for WILL is provided by Risk Management Commodities, presenting a winter planning meeting on Monday, January 20th at the Best Western Hotel and Conference Center in Lafayette, Indiana. Registration begins at 5, with dinner served at 5:30. RSVP to 866-837-9027.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now with a look at the futures market and other things as well is Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities, and he is in Newmarket, Indiana. Good afternoon, Wayne.
Well, good afternoon, Dave.
I thought that January soybeans went off the board at noon at a very interesting value at $13.39, because eventually it was a swing high that March has hit recently.
Yeah, it was. They finished very strong. We saw some very increased activity about the time that they were going off with all of the beans. You know, it did help that the noon weather forecast or the GFS model to come out at noon sort of reduced or cut back on some of the moisture and kept the heat in a little longer than southern Argentina. But, I mean, basically along the way, it told us, just as a lot of the advisory firms have been putting in their write-ups every morning, that we are tight of beans in the U.S., not necessarily in the world, but, you know, futures expiration on different contracts and like that would cause it to, you know, to come together as far as what the cash is worth just in the U.S. right now. Well, we pumped up and took the January beans right there.
So do you think that we can now realistically look at March beans potentially rallying to something around 1339?
You know, that's a possibility. The question is, do they go off and do we go down to where they were? Do we look at what the world will be by the time that March beans are delivered? And because as we're looking at things like that, we have to remember that, you know, by that point in time, we're going to start to see some export beans out of Brazil. And we're also going to possibly, it's right before the Lunar New Year holiday is when China started making some cancellations or shifting destination or origination points to South America. And that'll all happen before we get into delivery on that March. But I would imagine we'll try to see an attempt at that by the technical traders.
Let's turn our attention to corn, which did a whole lot of nothing. It tried to make a Fibonacci retracement at the 23% level of the movement back to August, but it pretty much finished where it ended at the start of the day.
You know, I mean, there's a lot to look at there, and we're thinking. I mean, we were in a 420 to 430 trading bracket there for an awful long time. That was pretty tight. You know, I think one of the numbers that a lot of people are looking at was a close over 436 was where there was a lot of buy stops. Were there, you know, 34 was as much as we could muster. You know, even if we do cut back a little bit here, a 1.4, a 1.5 or so carryout, still a very adequate number as far as it goes. Dave, remember we used to say anything over a billion bushels why we were somewhat burdensome, and now we're saying it just has to be under 1.5. But, the ethanol sales and production keeps running way at a pace, and that's what's really helping this corn market.
Yeah, that is indeed helping the corn market as well as suspected disappearance on the livestock sector.
Yeah, you know, let's face it, we're reading off those livestock closes. Those are some tremendous prices for cattle and hogs here right now. The cheaper price of corn, finally the poor livestock producer that was getting murdered here for the last couple of years had some very nice profits in here. And it looks like things are going to hang in here fairly well. I mean, because, you know, the PED and the cattle numbers are down, and we still all love to eat steak and pork chops.
And then I suppose very quickly, some recommendations on marketing of corn and beans. We have about a minute and 10 left.
Well, I mean, I think as we look at things here, we're old crop corn. I know that a couple advisory services did just market some old crop corn, another 10% here today, and we're thinking this 430 to 450 level is a place to do some of that. As far as the new crop corn, you know, we're looking up 460 to 475. We'd like to sell another increment of corn. Also, as we look at the beans, they're not quite up to where we'd like to sell them, but if we're a producer out there, we're looking very seriously at selling $12 calls to either augment if they don't get there. If they do get there, we'll be willing to be pricing beans at $12.40.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thanks, Dave.
Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities, and he is in Newmarket, Indiana. And that is our analysis today on the Closing Market Report.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason on the road with the Corn and Soybean Classics, coming to you today from Moline, Illinois, where we stayed at the Radisson, which reminds me that in March on the 10th, 11th, and 12th, when we travel to John Deere, if you haven't signed up for that bus trip, you can find it at willag.org. We'll stay here at the Radisson. And this is a funny little thing, but one of the unique things about the Radisson in Moline is that it has the number beds in it. Those are the ones that are really kind of fun and cool. If you haven't ever been in a sleep number bed and wanted to try one out, well, this trip might be a good way to do that. Anything to entice you to come along with us. We'll be heading to John Deere March 10 and 11. Watch the combines be made in Moline, and we'll run over to Waterloo the next day and watch them make the tractor. Should be a great trip. That's all right there on our website at willag.org. But for today, we're in Moline with the Corn and Soybean Classics. Joining us on the 17th year, as usual, is Mike Gray. He and I have been along for the ride each and every year, I believe, for almost all of them. Mike, an entomologist at the U of I. Your session today deals with an insect that you almost invariably deal with, the western corn rootworm. It continues to change, and farmers continue to have to battle it.
Well, that's right, Todd. The western corn rootworm is first and foremost on the minds of a lot of producers when they think of insect management challenges. It, by the way, of interest, is the number one most significant economic pest worldwide of corn. When you think of the dollars spent to control it, whether you're purchasing a BT hybrid or using a soil insecticide, and that plus the yield loss caused by this insect across a pretty good cross-section of the U.S., and of course we know that since the early 90s, the western corn rootworm also causes some management challenges for growers in Europe. So it's an important insect. It's one that we like to share information, research information, each and every year from a lot of our trials across the state. And it's always enjoyable to come out and interact with these growers at the Corn and Soybean Classics.
The western corn rootworm is an insect that has been able to thwart many of the attempts that producers have made to control it. One of the first things that happened would have been in the mid-1990s, where it adapted to crop rotation.
Well, that's right. Ironically, where we sit here today, this is where the western corn rootworm made its way into the state in 1964, showing up in Rock Island for the first time as it made its way into Illinois. About 20 years later, we were beginning to see that crop rotation was not working as well as it should. And, of course, by the time we got into the mid-90s, we had widespread damage across much of east-central Illinois. And it's a good example of even something like crop rotation, a cultural management strategy, if done repeatedly, as we did over time, the insect adapted, and we found that females began to lay eggs not just in the soil of cornfields, but in the soil of soybean fields, setting the stage for damage in rotated corn. Last year, in two counties of Illinois, Kankakee and Livingston County, for the first time, we found pretty significant root damage to BT corn, BT hybrids that express the Cry3BB1 protein, that was introduced into the marketplace first by Monsanto going back to 2003. It was really kind of the first example of where crop rotation and the use of a BT hybrid was not effective in limiting root damage. We collected, Joe Spencer, a colleague of mine in the Illinois Natural History Survey, Joe and I collected some adults. We will challenge the offspring of those adults in some bioassays to see if they, in fact, are resistant to this Cry3BB1 protein. At this point, it certainly looks suspicious. And so the concern is that we could have a segment, at least, of the rootworm population that is not only resistant to crop rotation, but resistant to that 1BT protein as well.
And factually, the same insect in Iowa has already been proven to be resistant to the YieldGuard, our first generation of BT corn.
That's correct. Iowa State entomologist Aaron Gassman, in a number of locations across northeastern and eastern Iowa has been able to confirm resistance to this Cry3BB1 protein. And as I've told producers at these corn and soybean classics, we only have four proteins out there in the marketplace right now for use in BT hybrids. And so we have to be pretty good stewards of those proteins, because there really is no transgenic technology on the near horizon. You know, as we look ahead to the end of decade, there are some promising technologies, particularly the RNAi technology looks at this point like it could be something very useful to help us combat Western corn rootworm. But that's still a bit down the road. So in the meantime, we've got four proteins. We need to use them effectively, judiciously, and try to target their use.
Factually, research takes a great deal of time. Farmers and researchers both sometimes can be ahead of the facts that come in. Farmers last year, and maybe potentially this year, knew that they were looking at battling a changed Western corn rootworm again that had adapted to the YieldGuard technology, or at least to that one BT technology, have begun to use soil insecticides in combination with their BT technologies. Is that a good or a bad idea, and has that changed over the last 24 months?
Well, that's a great question. And as we know, when these BT hybrids came into the marketplace about 10 years ago, there was a lot of excitement over the fact that, you know, as we moved more and more towards the use of this technology, that we would see reductions in soil insecticide use. I think that was of great appeal to a lot of producers. That meant, fewer storage issues, less handling, calibration of soil insecticides. Some environmental benefits certainly as well, but we now know that over the last several years, we've seen a pretty rapid increase in the use of soil insecticides by producers, and, in many cases, they're using soil insecticides on top of BT hybrids designed for corn rootworms. Our research, and I think the research from other land grants, has been pretty clear that we're not recommending the use of a soil insecticide at planting with so-called pyramided BT hybrids, the use of hybrids that express not just one, but two BT proteins for corn rootworm. We don't see benefit from using a soil insecticide on top of a pyramided BT hybrid. Growers that have had issues with performance with a particular type of BT hybrid that expresses only one trait, and they still want to stick with that a single trait, even though it has not performed as well, that's a little different story, and some of those growers are going to want to consider the use of a soil insecticide, because that may be the main rootworm protection that they have. Why would a grower elect to do that? Well, in some cases, growers believe that if they want access to elite germplasm, high-yielding germplasm, they choose to stick with a particular hybrid that may have performed well in the past for them. Another scenario where a grower may want to use a soil insecticide along with a BT hybrid would be where they have concerns over wireworms or white grubs. Maybe they've had a history of those two particular groups of soil insects. That's a little different story, because we know BT hybrids will not provide protection for wireworms and white grubs. And in that case, a soil insecticide along with a BT hybrid for rootworm makes sense.
I'd like to stay with the same topic but switch areas just a bit and talk about resistance management and development of resistance, and take up three particular lines, the European corn borer, the Western corn rootworm related to BT products, and the Western corn rootworm related to soil insecticides. So let's start with the European corn borer. This was the first insect that was controlled by a genetically modified organism, or a GM product, a BT corn product. That would have happened in the mid-1990s, yet it has not adapted, at least to this point, to the control method. Why would that be the case when the Western corn rootworm has been able to adapt in a mere 7 to 8 years?
Well, in 1996, BT hybrids were introduced into the marketplace for European corn borer. And you're right, Todd, we've not had the evolution of resistance to the BT proteins expressed for corn borer control. And that's a really great story. And the reason is that the BT hybrids in the marketplace for corn borer control are high-dose events. They kill an incredibly high percentage of corn borer larvae each and every year. And because we use this high-dose event along with a refuge, and remember for many years the standard refuge was that 20% structured refuge. That could be, you know, separate fields, blocks within fields. That combination of that refuge along with the high-dose events was a strategy that worked incredibly well for European corn borer. With regard to rootworm BT hybrids, these are low-dose events, and so they don't kill a high percentage of corn rootworm larvae. And the 20% refuge that we've used historically, the block, separate block, separate field, as it turns out, that kind of refuge, we now know, is really not ideal. The seed blend, the refuge in a bag approach, is really a preferable resistance management strategy from the respect from of using a non-BT seed. That seed blend, that seed mixture, is a preferred strategy for rootworm. So those are really kind of some of the reasons, the primary reasons, why BT has worked so well for corn borer, and we've had more challenges, certainly, for Western corn rootworm.
And with soil insecticides, the Western has not been able to adapt yet.
That's correct. We really have no evidence that Western corn rootworm have developed resistance to the soil insecticides applied at planting. And the main reason for that is these soil insecticides are applied in furrow or in a narrow band, in effect creating a refuge, if you will, between the rows. So for decades, growers, with really not even necessarily thinking about it, were actually deploying refuges out in these cornfields, allowing for survivors, insects that were not exposed to the soil insecticides. They did their job in most cases. That is, they protected the root zone. They prevented plants from lodging. But they also ensured survivorship of a lot of Western corn rootworm adults out in those fields that emerged between the treated areas.
Mike, thanks so much for taking the time with us today.
It's my pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
Mike Gray is on the Corn and Soybean Classics for 2014. We are scheduled to be in Mount Vernon and Champaign. Those two classics, of course, were canceled earlier in January. We will be in Mount Vernon on the 21st and right here in Champaign on the 28th. Right now, of course, we're in Moline, Illinois. One other item, if you have not signed up for our Voices of Illinois Agriculture event, just a couple more days to do that. It's scheduled for the 24th. That's a Friday evening. Should be a fantastic event. Gary Schnicki will be on that program, as well as Daryl Good. Also, Steve Freed from ADM Investor Services, and our keynote speaker for the Voices of Illinois Agriculture, President of the University, Bob Easter. We hope that you'll sign up. It's $100. We raise funds for University of Illinois College of ACES scholarships. It's a great event. It's a great evening in Bevier Hall. If you have not gone to one of these events, and there's only been one so far, right now would be a really great time to head to our website at willag.org, sign up, or you can just call our station at 217-333-7300. That's 217-333-7300 and ask about Voices of Illinois Agriculture. They'll be glad to send you along to the right people to get you all signed up. Just a couple of days to do that. That's the 24th day of January, just a week from this Friday, Voices of Illinois Agriculture in Bevier Hall. The students in the College of ACES will be putting together our meal for us. It will be a great night. I hope to see you there.
It's National Hot Pastrami Sandwich Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1784, the Continental Congress ratified the Treaty of Paris, officially establishing the independence of the new United States and establishing its borders. Signed in Paris on September 3rd of 1783 and negotiated for the U.S. by John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and John Jay, the agreement between the American colonies and Great Britain ended the American Revolution. In 1861, David Wesson was born. An American chemist, he created Wesson oil early in the 20th century. He experimented with purifying cottonseed oil, developed a system in 1900 to make the pure oil palatable, and formed the Southern Oil Company to market it. Wesson worked from 1901 to 1911 on a process for hydrogenating cottonseed oil. Cottonseed oil was the first vegetable oil used in the U.S. In 1885, Benjamin Silliman Jr. died, an American chemist. His report on the potential uses of crude oil products gave impetus to plans for drilling the first producing oil well in the U.S. in Pennsylvania. He noted its potential use as a lubricant, and he found it capable of withstanding extremely high and low temperatures and able to keep its form after long use. And that's this day in agricultural history. Meteorologist Don Day is away from his desk today, but here is agricultural weather from World Weather Incorporated's Drew Lerner.
The focus of interest right now isn't so much on the Midwest weather as much as it is on South America. The forecast models today are all over the board regarding how much rain will or will not fall in Argentina. That's going to create a bit of confusion, but the one thing that is for sure, over the next 4 or 5 days, we're going to see a considerable amount of stress across Argentina's crop country. Extreme high temperatures will likely get well up into the upper 90s and probably into the lower 100s, with extremes Thursday, Friday, and Saturday possibly getting up to around 110 degrees. The heat will precede an opportunity for rain, and that's where the debate comes in. Most forecasters are seeing a divergence in the models out there, with the European forecast model, along with one of the latest GFS or American model forecasts, suggesting that significant rain may fall over multiple days in portions of Argentina's crop country. And if it does happen, of course, there would be some significant relief to the persistent dry and heat that has been prevailing. The other models are suggesting, no, there will only be temporary relief, and that's where the debate is lying. Today's official forecast from World Weather Incorporated does suggest that there will be an opportunity for some relief to occur late in the weekend coming up, as well as next week across Argentina, and it will provide at least some short-term relief. We're not convinced, though, that the rains will be heavy enough in the southwest to bring on a permanent change. In the meantime, Brazil will continue to see ideal weather. One of the features that's on the forecast models today is that a ridge of high pressure may develop over southern Brazil during the middle part of next week, creating a warm and dry bias for them. But soil moisture in Brazil is so much better than Argentina that the impact on the crops will be minor. In the meanwhile, back across the Midwest, our forecast will continue to promote three little disturbances that will move across the region over this coming week, and we'll likely see each one bring an opportunity for snow across northern portions of the region, but no real substantial major storm system is likely to impact the region. The temperatures across the region will have a little bit of a cooler bias relative to where we were over the weekend, and we will see some bitter cold conditions occurring in the upper Midwest only. On Friday morning, some areas in Wisconsin and Minnesota may see temperatures like they're going to see tomorrow morning, and that is with readings in the negative single digits and perhaps a handful of negative teens. But the cold doesn't get very far to the southeast. Northern Illinois will see temperatures in the positive single digit readings to maybe near zero, but that's as far south as the cold air will get. And the rest of the Midwest will see lows mostly in the teens and some 20s over the next several days. And again, we don't expect to see major storm systems impact the region. There will be an ongoing dryness concern in the western United States, mostly in the far west, California and the Pacific Northwest, but also in the western portions of the U.S. plains, in portions of hard red winter wheat country, where there is a significant need for precipitation and some cooler temperatures. The western half of the country will see quite a bit warmer than normal conditions prevailing for a while. This will reduce winter hardiness in most of the high plains wheat production areas, and a concern about future crop conditions will rise until cooler and wetter conditions return. This is meteorologist Drew Lerner.
And that is today's Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey.